Briefing.
Ending the war in Gaza. Glad handing and grinding teeth. Will Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to America repair or weaken ties?
Rarely has so divisive a figure been so honoured by America's political class. On July 24th, Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, Israel's Prime Minister, will deliver his fourth address to a joint session of Congress, more than any other foreign leader, including Winston Churchill. It was as recently as March that Chuck Schumer, leader of the Democratic majority in the Senate, excoriated Mr. Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace and called for new elections to remove him. The snub was all the sharper, given that Mr. Schumer, Congress's most prominent Jewish member, thinks of himself as a shomer, or protector of Israel. 3 months later, the shomer yielded, joining other congressional leaders in inviting Mr. Netanyahu to give his oration. America's relationship with Israel is ironclad and transcends one person or prime minister, he explained. President Joe Biden, a friend to Israel but long exasperated by Mr. Netanyahu, will receive him at the White House too. The red carpet welcome, 9 months into the Gaza war, reflects the political cunning of Mr. Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister. American domestic politics is also a factor. Republicans decided to invite Mr. Netanyahu, daring Democrats to shun an ally. Above all, the visit is evidence of Israel's special hold on America's political imagination. Mr. Netanyahu is unpopular in Israel, where most want him to step down either immediately or after the war. In America, left-wing Democrats decry what they regard as his genocide in Gaza. Yet America's political elite still pays its dues to Israel's leader, as controversial as he is. Which Mr. Netanyahu will appear in Washington? The gracious one, thanking Mr. Biden for his extraordinary political and military help during the war? Or the cynical one, seeking to turn attention from Gaza to Iran and to obstruct Mr. Biden's effort to end the war? Probably both. Mr. Netanyahu has sent word that he will deliver a bipartisan speech. Many Democrats are suspicious, with good reason. In a video message in June, he complained about the inconceivable slowdown in American arms deliveries. Some suspect the Prime Minister wants to jab at a weakened Mr. Biden to ingratiate himself with Donald Trump. After the assassination attempt on the former president, Mr. Netanyahu claims he, too, is the object of incitement to violence by opponents. Democrats, though, remember how Mr. Netanyahu in 2015 came to rally Congress against Barack Obama's diplomatic deal to limit Iran's nuclear program. Bibi failed to stop the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, but got his way in the end when Mr. Trump abrogated it in 2018. This time, Mr. Netanyahu is resisting important parts of Mr. Biden's plan to stabilize the Middle East. Phase one envisages a 6-week ceasefire in Gaza, with a partial Israeli pullback from population centers and the exchange of some Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners. Phase two features a permanent ceasefire, with the full withdrawal of Israeli forces and the release of the remaining hostages. Phase three calls for a multi-year reconstruction plan for Gaza and the return of the remains of dead hostages. Beyond is a grand regional package to revive talks on Palestinian statehood and normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Mr. Netanyahu ostensibly supports much of this, but opposes the idea of a permanent halt to the war, blocking phase two. He spurns a role for the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority in running Gaza, and rejects all the more fiercely the notion of a Palestinian state, which probably kills the idea of a regional deal. Bibi's message used to be, "Only I can deliver America." Now it's only I can stand up to America, says Shalom Lipner of the Atlantic Council, an American think tank. Yet negotiators reckon the odds of a Phase 1 deal are improving. Hamas has dropped the demand for a permanent ceasefire from the outset, and Israel thinks it has killed Mohammed Deif, the head of Hamas's military wing, which may seem a sufficiently large scalp to allow it to claim it has beaten Hamas. A deal over Gaza, in turn, ought to end the worsening exchange of fire with Hezbollah, a Lebanese militia, over Israel's northern border. Mr. Netanyahu is under intense pressure from Israel's security establishment to accept the deal. He faces nightly protests demanding the return of the hostages. But far-right members of his coalition threaten to depose him if he accepts even Phase 1. A three-month recess of Israel's parliament, which begins on July 28th, and would briefly shield Mr. Netanyahu from efforts to topple his government, thus offers an opportunity to clinch a deal. America's hope is that even a temporary halt to the fighting will transform political dynamics, end the war permanently, and deny China, Iran, and Russia a potent rallying cry. Mr. Netanyahu, though, wants to turn the spotlight on what he sees as the ultimate cause of trouble, not the dispossession of Palestinians, but the aggression of Iran. He is likely to tell Congress that the war in Gaza is just one of seven fronts opened by Iran and its axis of resistance. The others are with Hamas in the West Bank, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, other militias in Syria and Iraq, and Iran itself, whose nuclear program is accelerating. He will probably denounce lawfare against Israel, not least the accusation of genocide being heard by the International Court of Justice, and claims of war crimes before the International Criminal Court. He may also claim that anti-Semitism and anti-Israeli prejudice are on the rise around the world. If Israel fails to destroy Hamas, Mr. Netanyahu believes all diplomatic manoeuvres are futile. No alternative Palestinian body can hope to run Gaza. No Arab state will help with security or reconstruction, and Israel will be less able to deter Iran. In fact, endless raids to stop Hamas regrouping are likely to destabilize Gaza indefinitely. Israelis, it is true, do not want a Palestinian state. Even so, Mr. Netanyahu's open discord with America strikes many of them as reckless. There is no national security without America, says Amos Gilad, a former defense official. And American officials add, if Bibi wants to deter Iran, why create a public rift with Israel's indispensable diplomatic and military protector? Mr. Netanyahu, though, thinks scraps with America can help him. He claims his complaint about American weapons speeded up their delivery. At any rate, America recently resumed supplies of 500-pound bombs, but not yet 2,000-pound ones. And Mr. Netanyahu reckons his fight with Mr. Obama over the JCPOA won the admiration of Gulf states, opening the way for the Abraham Accords, under which the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco established diplomatic relations with Israel in 2020 to 2021. Mr. Netanyahu anyhow takes a hard-nosed attitude to American politics. Bipartisanship towards Israel is waning. Most American Jews vote Democratic, but a growing share of Democrats sympathize with Palestinians, as do many younger voters. Republicans once tried harder to balance relations with Israel against priorities in the Arab world. Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush Sr. all at times turned the screws on Israel. But latterly, in part because of the influence of evangelical Christians, support for Israel has become a touchstone for mainstream Republicans. though his ties with Mr. Netanyahu are strained, Mr. Trump says America should let Israel finish the job against Hamas. Michael Oren, a former Israeli ambassador to Washington under Mr. Netanyahu, notes that the two countries have a peculiar sort of alliance. They have no formal mutual defence obligation. Israel has repeatedly been asked to lie low, for instance, during America's two wars against Iraq in 1991 and 2003. Yet they are intimately bound together through military technology and intelligence sharing. On April 13th, when Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel, America orchestrated a defence involving Britain, France, Jordan and Saudi Arabia. All but a handful of warheads were intercepted. The incident offered a glimpse of a new Middle East, exposing Israel's unprecedented vulnerability to missile attack from Iran's axis of resistance, but also hinting at an unprecedented counter-axis. Yet Mr. Netanyahu will not yield to American and Arab entreaties to move towards some minimal form of Palestinian state. Perhaps he thinks he can win over the Saudis without such concessions. Or perhaps he thinks no compromise can ever dispel the enmity of Israel's foes. Either way, he seems intent on redoubling investment in military technology, mobilizing the world against Iran, and decrying critics as ignorant or anti-Semitic. He will take broad American support where he can find it, but will make do with narrow, partisan backing if necessary. You could call it an Israel-first policy. Much of this approach is received sympathetically in Washington, even by the Biden administration. Yet there is another way of looking at Mr. Netanyahu's visit. Many think he is dragging out the fighting to extend his hold on power, despite the damage to Israel's budding relations with the Gulf and its decades-old alliance with America, not to mention the appalling human cost. Call it a Bibi-first strategy.